This is the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program. We're going to be talking today about literature for children. You know, the library children's area used to be a safe place to take your kids because the literature there was intended for children. By and large, the material was safe and often instructive and even sometimes inspiring. But when you look at children's literature today, you're looking at a very different reality. In fact, I have been writing about what I call the darkening of children's literature, these dark and ominous themes that are now coming in. As children are being treated to the themes and content, subject matter, that previously had been reserved for adults. And a lot of it, I think, is really perverse. Even where it's not perverse, it is fundamentally unhelpful, I think, to children. One of the things we'll be talking about today is why we should be very careful about children's literature, how we should, as parents and others, look at a lot of this literature coming out, what this tells us about our culture, and about how people would want to reach the minds of our children. We're going to have a very special guest, Dorothea Israel Wolfson, who has written an excellent essay on this issue, and I blogged about it at albertmohler.com. You have time before we open the phones to go and take a look at her article. And if you're ready to call, it's 877-893-8255, 877-893-TALK. First, a review of some of the issues in the news today. Of course, this is the one-year anniversary of the landfall of Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans. You know, it is interesting, isn't it, that even last week we were talking about this because the storm had emerged in the Caribbean and indeed it crossed the southern section of Florida before it ever set its sights directly on New Orleans. It is a reminder to us of so many things. First of all, the catastrophic tragedy that was Hurricane Katrina. It is also a reminder to us of what was both a natural and a human disaster. That is to say, not only did nature unleash its fury. And of course, I'm not just speaking here of nature as an impersonal force, but also recognizing that that we believe in a sovereign God who is in control of nature. But also there was a catastrophe of human dimensions, mismanagement, all kinds of bad decisions, human hubris when it comes to confidence in such things as dams and levees and all the rest, over against the massive force of a major hurricane like Katrina. The one-year anniversary is certainly recalling a lot of bad memories. We'll be seeing a lot of images, pictures, and we'll be hearing a lot of reflections from people who lived through the storm. But let's remember that even now, 1 year later, there are many churches that still are not able to meet in their buildings. There are many families that even now have been unable to go home. This is a reminder to us that a catastrophe and tragedy of the scale of Katrina, a disaster of this magnitude, is not something that we overcome quickly, but the American public attention moves on. And so this one-year anniversary is a good moral check for us. We need to remember that there are an awful lot of folks who have not moved on because they cannot move on, and they still need help. Well, it looks like the state of California needs help because California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger has signed into law Senate Bill 1441, which was sponsored by Sheila Kyle, a Democrat. We've been following her again and again. She had previously been mentioned on this program just this week because of the bill that she had introduced having to do with the education of California children. But this particular bill that was signed into law will force faith-based colleges, according to CNS News, to either abandon their biblical standards on sexuality or else reject students who receive state financial aid. The bill, SB 1441, says state-operated and state-funded programs may not discriminate against anyone based upon their sexual orientation or any number of other things. Randy Thomason, president of Campaign for Children and Families in California, said, quote, "People of conscience are appalled that Arnold Schwarzenegger has trampled religious freedom to satisfy hyperactive sexual activists." He went on to say, if signed into law, as it now has been, Senate Bill 1441 would mean religious colleges, those colleges that accept students with state financial aid, children's daycare centers, and after-school programs would be forced to allow men to wear women's dresses and hire transsexual, bisexual, or homosexual instructors. Now, this story is still developing, and already on websites, people on both sides of the issues are posting their report. 360 Gay, that is 365 Gay, which is a major homosexual news website, is celebrating this, suggesting that California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger has signed legislation just today banning discrimination in the state in any state-operated or funded programs on the basis of actual or perceived sexual orientation or gender identity. The legislation, according to 365 Gay, is designed to protect from discrimination Californians who utilize public services such as police and fire protection, financial aid, social services, and food stamps. Now, this, again, just points to what is going to be one of the toughest issues in this culture. And that is to say, what do you do as a Christian institution, as a Christian school, when a regulation like this or a law is handed down in your state or in some cases municipality or even by some accrediting agencies? It is a test of conscience and basic Christian identity. And even as it now appears that these will be days that will challenge institutions in California, just wait. This is a pattern you can expect to see spread across the nation. We'll be tracking this story with you and let you know how it develops even in upcoming days. Meanwhile, there are other things related in the news. You'll remember that the story came out just yesterday of two Fox News journalists who were released after being forced to, quote, convert, end quote, to Islam at the point of a gun. There is a lot of news out there and analysis now. One particular story is looking at the fact that the New York Times reported that these two correspondents were released, quote, unharmed, after having been forced to convert at the point of a gun. This raises all kinds of questions, particularly for the Christian conscience, but these are not new questions. This goes all the way back to the earliest Christian experience when, under persecution from the Roman Empire, Christians at the point of death were told that they must convert. The Christian response has been consistently throughout the history of the Christian church, the response given by the Apostle Paul and others, and that is, that we simply cannot recount the faith. You think of Peter and John before the Sanhedrin in Acts chapter 4. We cannot deny Christ nor fail to proclaim him. But you think about what's really going on. This says a great deal, doesn't it, about Islam? That they would even treat conversion as something that could be accomplished at the point of a gun? News reports coming out of Australia indicate that two evangelical pastors there were found guilty 20 months ago of vilifying Muslims, and they are now threatened to go to prison if they fail in an appeal currently underway in the city of Melbourne. A Washington, D.C. public interest law firm, the Beckett Fund for Religious Liberty, is defending them on their appeal. The two are appealing against a decision by a legal tribunal in the state of Victoria in Australia, which ruled that they had violated the state's controversial religious hatred law. In other words, these two pastors spoke against Islam, and in so doing, they were charged with an offense, a legal offense, a crime, in having spoken words of religious hatred. This was, by the way, something that took place in a seminar. Pastor Daniel Scott presented a seminar on Islam, which is organized by another pastor, Danny Nahila, and his organization, Catch the Fire Ministries. According to the judge in Victoria, the tribunal, the address given by Pastor Scott was, quote, essentially hostile, demeaning, and derogatory of all Muslim people, their God, Allah, the Prophet Muhammad, and in general Muslim religious beliefs and practices, end quote. Well, it looks to me like that verdict could come down on any authentic Christian response to Islam. I mean, after all, what do we have to say? We do not believe that Allah is God, because Allah, as presented in the Quran, is a direct refutation of the central Christian belief that the one true God is the triune God of Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. The character of Allah is not the character of Jehovah, God the Father of our Lord Jesus Christ. There is no way that any Christian can speak of Islam without speaking of this basic distinction in beliefs. It need not be said with hatred. It need not be said with any intention to incite offense. But the fact is, there is a basic collision here of worldviews and belief systems, And woe unto the country that claims to believe in religious freedom, that would threaten to put two pastors in jail for simply making the case of the distinction in beliefs between Christianity and Islam and making clear that they are Christians. This whole category, folks, of hate speech is slippery, dangerous, and entrapping. Because what it really represents is the shutdown of free speech, and in this case, the shutdown of anything you could call authentic religious liberty. We'll be back to talk about the darkening, the negativity, the descent of children's literature. We have a special guest, Dorothea Israel Wolfson, and we'll be talking about what it means not only for your children, but for the culture at large. This is the Albert Mohler Program. Welcome back. We've been talking about young adult literature several times on this program lately. We've been looking at some of the books, especially looking to the summer. We were looking at the offerings that came from the spring, noticing the kind of basically pornography that was being presented to young adults. But there is also something happening in children's literature. I've referred to it as a darkening of that literature. I came across an essay in the Claremont Review. And Dorothea Israel Wolfson has written what I think is a brilliant piece, really dealing with what has happened to children's literature and why it makes such a big difference. As I said, the library used to be a safe place to take your kid, and especially to the children's section. But this stuff is getting pretty dark. She is reviewing in her article the Norton Anthology of Children's Literature. She describes it as a 2,471-page lap-crushing anthology. But it's not the size of it that really has her attention. It is the descent of children's literature. She quotes in here, by the way, the editors who write, quote, "There are today no real taboos in domestic fiction for young adults and few in books for the youngest readers. Family stories now tackle every painful issue imaginable." And Dr. Wolfson, who teaches Johns Hopkins University and the Center for the Study of American Government, makes clear that's what is represented in this anthology. Dr. Wolfson, welcome to the Albert Mohler Program.
Oh, well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be speaking with you.
Well, I really appreciated your review essay. And by the way, I want to point out you're also the mother of four children, so you speak with a double credibility here.
Yes, I think that does give me some authority.
Absolutely. Dr. Wolfson, in your review essay, looking at the Norton Anthology, you're really pointing to something that's troubled me for some time. We are treating children as if they need to read the same kind of literature that is written and published for adults.
Yes, that's true. And in fact, while people like you and me and others worry about that, what I found so troubling about this anthology was there was a celebration of that fact, that we should be, you know, treating children like adults and exposing them to the realities of the world and how this is a great revolution in children's literature, whereas I think it's really, as I said in the review, marks the end of it.
Well, you know, I in reading your review, was struck by the thought. I was remembering Bruno Bettelheim, the late psychiatrist, who wrote about the uses of enchantment. One of the points he made is that children's fairy tales really were ways of introducing children to a dangerous world. Thinking of the story, for instance, of Hansel and Gretel. There really are dangerous people out there in the world. There really are lessons to be learned. But what you're arguing is that as I don't want to put words in your mouth, I want to ask you to make the argument yourself. But basically, that what we have now is that there is no fairy tale. It's just the story.
Right, exactly. I mean, yes, fairy tales deal with all sorts of horrific things, and reading them to my children, they sometimes get afraid of Hansel and Gretel and things like that. But they're written in a way that sort of presents evil as sort of archetypes, and not sort of these, you know, that they sort of hide them under characters that introduce the child to evil, but they don't have to confront it directly. Whereas I think in my article, I talk about the latest edition of Little Red Riding Hood, which was celebrated in this anthology, in which they don't try to veil it under anything. They just talk about
Well, let me read from your essay here.
Oh, sure. Okay.
Because what you said is the editors tell us that the story, quote, shows how a young girl can take charge of her life while at the same time exposing the sadomasochistic ties that exist in many dysfunctional families, end quote.
Right, right. And they're very graphic. In fact, I didn't put it in the review, but they use very graphic language, including the F word, and to describe this, you know, this story. And I was.
And this
really
is for children.
Yes, yes. Well, I must say that the anthology, as I point out in my review, it's supposed to be aimed, which is even in some ways worse. It's for the undergraduate curriculum to teach anybody who goes off to college and wants to major in English would be probably in study children's literature. This, they're aiming it at them, but they're going to go out and teach, and it's going to sort of filter down to the rest of society. So, yes, eventually a child probably would read that book and you know, draw those crazy lessons from it. But,
right,
yeah.
And the book Wolf you mentioned there, which is supposedly an updating of the Red Riding Hood story, is written for children.
Oh, yes, and, yes. That was written for children, yes.
Yeah, and I checked, it's still available.
Oh, yes.
I want to quote what I think is just a brilliant section of your review. You write, the editors, however, wish to promote a revolution of their own, a new, more candid, and frankly more nihilistic corpus. Despite heralding children's literature as life-enhancing and life-changing, the Norton editors aim, in fact, to dampen children's enchantment with the world, forcing them to acquiesce to the grim realities and multicultural obsessions of contemporary adults. I just love that expression, grim realities and multicultural obsessions, because I think you're reading what I'm reading.
Oh, yes, definitely. I mean, all these stories, even stories that don't seem to have any sort of, just sort of like Anne of Green Gables, for example, about this really this little orphan with lots of pluck, that's just simply about a middle-class white family. I mean, everything has to be reduced to, you know, its gender or its class, and children don't look at books that way. They like a good story. And, right, so everything has to be analyzed through the lens of race and class, which I think is was just very foreign to children who don't really recognize that at all. Right, and plus, just to sort of deprive children of childhood. I mean, the invention of childhood was a great great boon for children, that they were recognized as different from adults, that they did have an innocence and a more tender mind that was very impressionable, and we should celebrate that and prolong that as long as possible. But now we're in such a rush to have them embrace the adult world with all its corruptions, and I think that's just a real tragedy for children.
You know, I want to test a thesis with you. I think there may be an even more sinister motivation here, and that is even to normalize some of these things. And of course, we have children's books like Heather Has Two Mommies and
right.
Daddy's Roommate and things like that. They're just unabashed attempts to make such relationships look normal, because stories have such a way into a child's heart.
Exactly. Oh, yes. I mean, there's a lot at stake here. This is not, when I first thought, I'll review a children's anthology, you know, it'd be kind of fun, but then I realized this is really important, because this is when you can capture their minds when they're children. They're so impressionable, and philosophers from Plato on have understood that. And so that's what makes this so subversive, is that they are trying to normalize things, or I think it's Patrick Moynihan once said, defining deviancy down and making things like the dysfunctional family just like any other family, that there's no such thing as dysfunction, that there's not you can't sort of prioritize like a family with a mom and a dad is perhaps preferable than one that is a single parent family. I mean, these things happen, but you don't want to. That's something that's sad. But they try
right.
to normalize that as much as possible.
There also seems to be a subversive element here in terms of the authority of parents. I mean, a lot of these stories really sow seeds of deep mistrust and suspicion about parents.
Oh yes, oh yes, they're the bad guys, and these are the new villains. Yeah, no, there really is, and I've noticed this in children's literature in general, that there's been a sort of a celebration of bad behavior in writing these. I mean, they seem sort of like innocent children's books, but sort of making misbehavior more interesting than good behavior, or making the parent absent. And we see that in our culture, in a lot of the popular TV shows and whatnot. And yeah, I think it's a real problem.
Now, let me just ask you, as both an academic and a mom, what kind of literature do you recommend?
Well, I think there's some really good stuff out there. I think anything, you know, that's before 1970, but there's also some really good things. My daughter, and we're reading Alice in Wonderland right now, which is just wonderful. She likes the Boxcar Children, the Gertrude Warner books. Bill Bennett has written some wonderful anthologies. I mean, there are some good anthologies out there, so
good
you have
word.
To search for them.
Dorothea Israel Wolfson is a professor at Johns Hopkins University Center for the Study of American Government. Her essay can be found at the Claremont Review of Books. I blogged about it with a link at albertmoeller.com. Dr. Wolfson, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you.
Folks, we'll be back with your calls, the number 877-893-8255. I would love to hear from some parents out there. Tell us what you're finding as you are looking for literature to read to your children. And tell me, please, that you're reading to your children. The number 877-893-8255, coast to coast. This is the Albert Mohler Program.
Listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. One of the most important things we can do is to introduce our children to books and stories. And the best way to do that, of course, is to read to them. And if you have young children, I hope they regularly crawl up into your lap for a good story. I hope you're crawling into bed and, letting them crowd around as you show them picture books and let them see the pictures and hear the story. Stories have an enormous power to reach into a child's heart. By the way, that's mirrored in the Bible when in Deuteronomy chapter 6, Israel is told that they are to teach their children when your son comes to you in time to come, saying, you know, what are the meaning of these things? Found also in Joshua. Then the patriarch was to say, this is to remind us of who God is because he brought us safely out of Egypt. You know, there's a story to be told there. The story helps the child to know who he is, who she is. And these stories are very important aspirationally for children. I mean, how many little girls have wanted to be the princess in the story, to dress up like the princess and to imagine themselves in a princess wedding or something like that? There are important moral lessons from these stories, not only things like Aesop's fables, but even things, as we mentioned, like Hansel and Gretel. There are real warnings in these stories. Don't go home with a stranger. Don't take candy from a stranger. You know, there are things children need to know. And stories can be safe and very effective ways of getting that across to them. And besides that, children have incredible imaginative power. That's a part of what it means to be a child. They're not cynical enough to bracket their imagination now with some unused capacity as an adult. Which, by the way, footnote number 4, I guess, in this conversation, is one reason why television shuts down the imagination while the reading of books opens the imagination. Because the child has to provide her own pictures. And, for instance, you tell a princess story, that little girl is going to have all these different imaginative faces that may emerge, different dresses and gowns, the palace she'll imagine, the castle in her own eyes. You show her a video, and she doesn't have to do any of that work. That imaginative power stays dormant. But what we were talking about today with Dorothea Israel Wolfson is the fact that children's literature is just getting really dark. When you walk into the bookstore today, you can go into a trade bookstore or the children's section of the library, and you can find books for children, young children, preschool children, dealing with the most wretched and dysfunctional issues. Incest. You name it. What are you doing with your children? How are you protecting them? What kind of literature are you reading to them? What's really going on in children's literature today? The phone number, 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Out there listening are an awful lot of parents and grandparents who are buying books and reading books and sharing stories with children. Let's talk about how, as Christians, we should be discriminating, careful, in thinking about what our children should and shouldn't read, and what should and shouldn't be read to them. You know, my wife and I have often remarked that even stories that seem innocuous often are not. For instance, the Berenstain Bears series. You know, those are clever little stories, and generally they have, very positive moral tales. You know, you're supposed to clean your room, you're supposed to do your homework, you're supposed to be nice to your sister. But there's something a little, in no other words, I'd have to say subversive in that story as well, and that is that the dad generally comes off as being stupid. It's the mom that always seems to be the one who understands where dad is pretty dense. Well, that's not a very helpful message to share with children. And yet it's one that is becoming very, very common in the literature. We've talked about the young adult fiction. And at the beginning of the summer, I shared some of what was new on the book table for teenage kids, for both boys and girls, and especially this stuff for teenage girls. It is so highly sexualized. It is just incredibly sexualized. You start looking at that, and I just find it hard to believe that any parent, would want their daughter reading that kind of literature. Now, when it comes to adolescent and pre-adolescent boys, we have another problem, and that is whether they are encouraged to read at all. But there, too, what are they reading? What is going into those eyes, through those eyes into the brain, and through the brain into the heart? Very important question. The phone number, 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. The darkening of children's literature tells us a great deal about how this culture views children. No longer treating children as little lives to be protected in a sense of innocence from some knowledge, but now treating them just like adults. No longer any taboos, say the editors of the Norton Children's Literature Anthology. I want to know what you say. 877-893-8255. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Albert Miller Program. We're talking about the darkening of literature for children and young adults, all kinds of themes that would never have been presented to children before, storylines, characters, and issues such as incest and dysfunctional families and all this presented to children in an effort, to rob them of their innocence on these issues and also, I think, to normalize an awful lot of these lifestyles and behaviors and arrangements and all the rest. There's other stuff out there, a tearing down of adult authority, a subversion of parents, just lots of stuff in this literature that is not healthy. The phone number is 877-893-8255. Give us a call. Tell us how you as parents, grandparents, or educators are dealing with this, what you'd recommend, what kind of counsel you would offer your fellow Christian parents. Let's go to Oneida, Tennessee, where Lisa's on the line, listening on XM 170. Go ahead, Lisa.
Hi, Dr. Mueller. I just agree with everything that you said. I certainly don't have any of that inappropriate kind of books in the house for my children. I have two daughters, almost 14 and 10, and I just feel strongly about I try to read to the two of them together. It doesn't happen as often as I'd like with our schedules, but, for example, I read The Big Wave to them by Pearl Buck, very small book.
Mm-hmm.
Like the summer before the tsunami hit, and it just was really meaningful to us because of that story. I mean, before the tsunami hit, you know, and was so real in our lives, we were like, wow, you know, I don't know if you're familiar with that story, but...
Yes, I am.
And, you know, just I try to read to them together. Currently, we're reading the Rosa Parks story. And, you know, just Max Lucado children's books, and I've read The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn. But when my first daughter was a newborn, I had the privilege of going to hear Jim Trelease. I don't know if you're familiar with him, a big advocate on reading to your children aloud at every age.
Hmm.
You haven't heard of him?
No, but I'm glad to hear of him, and I certainly would join him in that advocacy.
He speaks all over, and he has his own, I guess, anthologies or whatever that you would, I think he has a thing called the Read Aloud Handbook, where he offers, it's a great tool for parents. He offers.
Now, Lisa, excuse me for interrupting. I want to ask you a question.
Sure.
You know, you would, I'm just guessing here, you would not just set your girls loose in a bookstore and say, buy whatever appeals to you.
Never.
So you know something of what's out there.
Yeah. Now, I'll tell you, my older daughter, who's she's just about to turn 14, she's academically advanced. My husband felt it was okay for her to read the Harry Potter books, and I wasn't so sure if she has read them. But that's, you know, I don't know about that. I felt a little bit uncomfortable, but that would be the worst.
Yeah.
So we don't do anything else with Harry Potter.
Well, when you talk about the worst, you know, I can just guarantee you, Lisa, and you know this already, that there are books written for girls age 13, 14, 15 that are just basically pornographic. I want to encourage you to continue doing what you're doing, reading aloud to your girls and watching and guarding their hearts by what you allow in terms of those stories. Appreciate your call, Lisa. You know, we were talking about different things here, you know, concerning what kind of literature you really can recommend. Let me recommend something that Christian parents really ought to be thinking about, and that is read stories from the Bible. You know, you don't even have to have help with that. Just pick up the Bible and read the story and explain it to your children. They are amazing stories. I've also had recommended the book by David Helm, which is entitled The Big Picture Story Bible. It's published by Crossway. It's just the kind of thing that helps you as a parent to tell these stories to your children and see their eyes light up and also understand that the Word of God will take root in their hearts. And the big picture is something that's really, really important. You know, how does this story fit into the big story of how Jesus loves me and what God intends for me in Christ? These are big issues. You know, one of the things about literature is that in times past, literature taught children whom to trust. You don't trust strangers, but you do trust your parents. You trust authority figures. You trust your teacher. But you don't trust, you know, like in Little Red Riding Hood, the wolf in the mask in the bed. And you also, as children, were taught to be attentive. Look for the fangs. You know, look for the wolf's teeth. And, you know, be very, very careful about such things. There were life lessons that were taught in these stories. That's very, very different than what you see in this literature today. Very different. Let's go to Fairmont, Nebraska, where Joe's on the line. Go ahead, Joe.
Yes. A year ago, I finished my library media endorsement and noticed that there is a tendency in books to show lack of respect for authority, parents and fathers in particular, I guess.
Yes. Yeah, Joe, you're exactly right.
And it's frightening.
So, Joe, tell us, you have children?
Yes, I do.
Okay, so what kind of stories are you reading to them? Or if they're of reading age, what kind of stories are you encouraging them to read?
Well, I have a 14-year-old, and we don't do any Harry Potter, that type of thing. She likes...
Well, she probably likes
it. She kind of likes historical fiction, I guess.
Yeah, and that's the kind of stuff. You know, you've got old stuff like the Laura Ingalls Wilder books, just in terms of secular literature. It comes from a very wholesome worldview. And there are also materials available through groups like Focus on the Family, Adventures in Odyssey, and other books written for preteen girls and teenage girls and for the guys as well. You know, when you start looking at this kind of literature, you understand that the difference between good and bad isn't always visible on the cover. You know, the cover can look very attractive, and indeed, mainline publishers are publishing a lot of this. You know, one of the things that I have brought out on this program is how a company like Scholastic Books, you know, you remember it used to have book fairs and the book truck and all these things, and Scholastic used to come, and you used to think as a parent, well, certainly I can trust Scholastic. Well, no, actually, you can't. Bad stuff. Some of it very, very bad in terms of treating sexuality and lifestyle issues and all the rest coming out in some of those books. Very, very unhelpful. You know, when we talk about stories, we're talking about the ability to captivate the imagination. And I hope you are helping your children to develop that capacity. They need it. It is no accident that in the Bible, stories are one of the main vehicles for helping to teach God's truth. Just as parables were used by Jesus, just as stories in the Old Testament were used, even in the New, to draw our attention to God's truth, we need to help our children to have a narrative imagination, to understand the power of a story. You watch a child's eyes when they're hearing a good story, and you know exactly what I'm talking about. I'll be right back. You know, folks, fairly regularly these days, we're kind of finding out where we stand over against the popular culture. And last night on Larry King Live, there was something said by Bill Maher. I guess no surprise there. It's hard to be outraged anymore by Bill Maher. But he said something last night on Larry King Live that is getting some attention. Just listen.
First of all, I think the bottom line is that religion makes people arrogant. One of the things I don't like about religion is I think it is arrogance masquerading.
You're blaming religion?
I think religion is usually, especially in this country, it's arrogance masquerading as humility. I think, you know, when Mel Gibson said, I own Malibu, that doesn't surprise me. Because when you think you have absolute certitude about what happens after you die and who God is, that's awfully arrogant to me.
It's very interesting, and I don't mean to throw stones here, but it's hard for me to take Bill Maher calling anyone arrogant. To watch him is to see the very quintessence of arrogance on television. But this does tell us about something of where we stand. You know, because when Mr. Maher says, when you think you have absolute certitude about what happens after you die and who God is, that's awfully arrogant to me. You know, he's got a point. If this was something we came up with, it would be awfully arrogant. If we acted as if we were smart enough and wise enough and discerning enough to figure all this out on our own, it would be, well, the epitome of arrogance. But the bottom line is, we didn't figure this out. We're not smart enough to have come up with this. This was all revealed to us by God himself. You know, we didn't figure him out. He revealed himself to us. We did not define him. He spoke and defined himself. You know, when you think about it, it would be arrogance of an unspeakable degree to refuse God the right to speak and to refuse God the right to define himself and tell us who we are and what he has done and what he expects of us. You know, when Bill Maher speaks of the bottom line being that religion makes people arrogant, maybe we need to recognize that some people come off that way. Maybe there are some people who are made arrogant. And I'm even willing to concede that religion will do that. If you think it's something you've done, if you think it's something you can do, if you think it's a matter of works righteousness and all the rest, then you probably will come off like the Pharisees, looking pretty arrogant. But when you recognize it's all by the grace and mercy of God, from the fact that God has spoken to us of his mercy to the fact that he has saved us in Christ of his mercy, there is no ground for arrogance. Perhaps we should even be thankful to Mr. Maher for kind of telling us where we stand and reminding us of what's at stake. I'll meet you tomorrow for Ask Anything Wednesday. We'll talk about what's on your mind. I'll see you then.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmohler.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmohler.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.